Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival panel on the human face, literature that's bringing human rights to life. I am Clara Long, and I'll be your moderator today. I'm a researcher on border and immigration issues at Human Rights Watch. And we have here with us this really wonderful panel of authors who have provided me a great reading list in the past couple weeks that I've just immensely enjoyed. To my left is Erin Bobrow-Strain, who is the author of this book, The Death and Life of Ada Hernandez. Next to him is Atiya Abawi, the author of her book, helpfully displayed, is her book, The Land of Permanent Goodbyes. And then finally, Elliot Pattison, whose book, Bones of the Earth, is also before us today. And I'm really looking forward to having a discussion with you all, and then for folks who are here in the audience to join in and sort of engage with, I think, the many different but also very related themes that are coming out in these books. One thing that struck me is the way in which each of these books are really delving in to the psyche of a particular individual or individuals. It seems like for each of you, you might have very, I'm so curious to hear the stories of how you entered into those characters, both in the nonfiction sort of ethnography, journalism work that you've done, Erin, but then also these fiction books that are so deeply related to actual events and real situations in the world. So, Erin, since you're to my left, I'd like to sort of start with you. I'd be, would love to hear a little bit about, if you could sort of introduce the story that you're telling here, but also how you came to develop the relationships that allowed you to tell that story.
Yeah. Thanks, and thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm making a shift here because I was on a really wonky policy panel this morning, so thinking about process and writing is really important right now. The broad overview is that this book tells the story of a young undocumented woman growing up in the small Arizona border town of Douglas, Arizona, from 1996 to 2016, from age 8 to age almost 30. And it kind of follows her life, and there are many. She comes to the border right at the moment that our new system, what was then the new system of approaching border security, is being created and crafted, and it slams into the town of Douglas, Arizona, right around 1996, 1997. So her life kind of tracks along with this system of our approach to border security that is now the dominant model of border security that we're seeing the cruelties and the repercussions of today. It actually dates quite far back. So it follows her story, and but really before there was any people in the book, there was a place. And I had had a long, I'd worked on the U.S.-Mexico border in the early 1990s and mid-1990s when this new border security approach was getting hashed out and created. And I came back to the border regularly after that, bringing students to do a summer field school on the border. And we talked to people from across the political spectrum and really over many years kind of watched the border changing. And around 2013, I started to think about the stories that were coming out of the border. And I was realizing that there was a lot of amazing writing and reporting being done about how the approach to border security impacted migrants who are passing through the border, people making the journey through Mexico, through Central America, across the deserts. There were increasingly a number of books about kind of the structures of border enforcement and our model of prevention through deterrence, and even kind of good books talking about the lives of Border Patrol agents. But I was, what about the border communities themselves? What happens when a community that has, for since it's begun, been intertwined with the other side of the border. Lives are lived across. Commerce, culture, everything crosses the border in this community. What happens when policies far from the border, crafted with very little attention to the realities of life on the border or migration, kind of crash into this town? So I went to Douglas in 2014 to do that. And as part of that, one of my early guides to the town was a woman named Rosy Mendoza, who becomes a major character or major person in the book. And she's a badass former undocumented social worker who works with victims of domestic and sexual violence on the border. And at a certain point, she said, there's a woman, a client who's become a friend, and I can't tell you anything about her, but I'll tell her about your project. And if she wants to call you, she will. And if she does call you, you should talk to her. And a few months pass, and I continue to interview other people and think about the border in big, more political terms. And then eventually, Aida Hernandez called, and we met. We met in a park, and we talked about what I was doing in Douglas, and we laughed about her favorite cult David Bowie movie, Labyrinth. And then she told me her story, and not all of it. Really, to understand more took many years of working together, collaborating together. But it really struck me, and my ideas for the book changed at that moment, because I was struck by the fact that when she told her story, it's a harrowing story, it's a brutal story, as you'll see if you read the book. But the way she told the story did not ask for pity. It asked for a reckoning with the way we have created policies of immigration on the border that have made her life almost unlivable. And it also kind of conveyed a certain brio and wit and humor and pride at having survived by the seat of her pants that I think is really central to a lot of immigrant stories, but gets left out of journalism that often is searching for the kind of the passive victim or of the tragic immigrant tale. And so I thought that had a real message for people in the United States, both about the value and the dignity of people who live really messy, complicated lives on the border, and also the way our policies, supposedly crafted to keep us safe, have made her life almost unlivable. And so from then it was a process of many years of talking about the risks and dangers of the book and trying to make it as collaborative a project as possible, working back and forth with her reading drafts and shaping the project, meeting and interviewing family and friends and other people whose lives intersected with hers, and just spending a lot of time together. There were many borders that separated us. Race and class and gender, and professional boundaries, but we went through a lot together, and I think that made the book a deeper, richer kind of thing.
Thank you. Yeah, Atiyah, when I think about this and your work here, I mean, I understand you did an enormous amount of reporting to inform a fictional account, and I wondered how you. I mean, one, how did the decision to write fiction come to you as a reporter, as a journalist, and how did you relate that reporting to the writing that you've done here?
Well, it was always a dream of mine to write a novel, but after years of being a journalist, particularly covering wars, I lived in Afghanistan for 4.5 years and Jerusalem for 5.5, and I covered the Iraq War as well. That dream of writing a novel slowly withered away because I started losing my imagination. And let's be honest, as a journalist, you shouldn't be using your imagination. So I saw that dream kind of dying. And then Philomil, the imprint for Penguin, was looking for an author to write a novel based in Afghanistan, which was my first book. And the approach that I take is still as a journalist, because I don't have that imagination anymore. But what I do is I take all the interviews that I've had, all the people that I've met, everything that I've seen, every bit of color in my book, every story that I tell is someone's story that's just been combined into one novel. So the first book was in a way to explain Afghanistan, and this book, A Land of Permanent Goodbyes, is to try to explain the Syrian refugee crisis in a way that I can't as a journalist. For television, at the most, I had 2 minutes to share a story. Sometimes I had 42 seconds. I remember on the nightly news, they were like, you have 42 seconds, tell us what happened today. I'm like, how am I going to do that in 42 seconds? But I would do it. And if I wrote something for .com, I had 750 words. And you can't really give a full picture when you have such little time and little space. So what I've gone about in my novels is, in a way, hopefully, for those who are interested in the topics, to pick up the book to understand it more. I remember, at least with A Land of Permanent Goodbyes, I had my first child at the time. I was living in Jerusalem. I was comfortably sitting in my apartment, watching the news, nursing my son. And I saw the refugee crisis on our screens, as everyone else did as well. And I kept thinking about how lucky I was, because my parents and myself, we were refugees. My mother escaped Afghanistan when she was 8 months pregnant with me. My brother was two. My father obviously was with her. And it was a harrowing journey of their own. And then when I was seeing mothers pushing strollers on the sides of highways, I thought about my own family. And at the time, I was actually researching a book on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, because that's what my publisher wanted. And then I called them and I said, my heart and my mind right now is focused on the refugees. Can I please change my topic? And luckily, I have an incredible editor who was very open to that. And what I did was I took my first trip to Turkey with my son to do as a journalist. And luckily, my dad came along and took care of my son while I did my interviews. And it was my first trip away from him when I went to Greece to interview the refugees, to go to the Aegean Sea, to watch the refugees come on the dinghies. And I found it to be a really important way to tell the story, because I'm giving you the truth. And I feel I owe it to not just the readers to read the truth, to see what's going on, but I also owe it to the people that I'm writing about. My biggest concern is for a Syrian to pick up this book and say, well, this isn't my story. So what I did is I worked alongside Syrian refugees. It was not just the interviews. I remember I couldn't get into Raqqa, and I have a couple chapters based in Raqqa. So I contacted a journalist from Raqqa. A doctor from Raqqa. And he was actually a citizen journalist and worked with other citizen journalists in the area. And every word I've written, he went through. He would tell me, this is more what it's like. You got that bit wrong. And he was a busy man, but he still went through 30,000 words on just on Raqqa to make sure that I had every single word written correctly for both the Syrians that I'm writing about and for the readers themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I just ask you to say a little bit for those who haven't read the book? I mean, your book follows a young man named Tarek. Can you say just a little bit about teaser, sort of what's...
Yeah. So my book follows a young teenager named Tarek. He has a normal life in a Syrian city, and his life is turned upside down when the war starts. He loses family members, and the surviving family members need to find their way out, and it's really a struggle to survive, risking their lives to survive. I originally started writing it from his point of view, and then I decided that didn't work. Then I started writing it in third person, and then I also decided that didn't work. And for some reason, destiny came to mind. So my book is actually narrated by destiny, because I really thought about who knows the story about humanity when it comes to migration. Literally everyone in this room, all of us, have a history of migration, whether we remember it or not, whether it was our ancestors or if it was us. It could be forced migration, it could be refugees, it could be displacement, whatever that may be. So I thought to myself, destiny's the best person to tell that story. So this story follows Tarek leaving Syria, finding his way to Turkey, and trying to find his way to Europe. At the same time, he's dealing with the idea of saying a permanent goodbye, which goes into the title. When we graduate from high school, college, wherever we leave our jobs, we say goodbye to people, and we don't necessarily see it as a permanent goodbye. We could bump into them later. We can have reunions. We could see them in a grocery store 20 years from now. But when you leave as a refugee, when you leave your country, everything that you've known, your foundation, your history, Oftentimes, you're saying a permanent goodbye. When my parents left Afghanistan, where they were originally from, they thought they'd go back. You know, I remember as a kid watching the news and my parents saying, when we go back, this is going to happen. When we go back, this is going to happen. And they never had that chance because there's been ongoing wars. And unfortunately, that seems to be what's happening in Syria right now, too. I want to add one thing. So although this also follows Tarek's story, I do have the character of Alexia. And I have a story about the volunteers who I met along the way there. People from all over the world who've given up their time, their money, to come help refugees as well. It's about the helpers and the hunters and how we have so many bad things that we see out there, people that are against refugees, against immigrants. But there's the people that we don't focus on, which is the helpers. And we all have a little bit of both inside each one of us. And the volunteers that would come out to make cheese sandwiches, to help a hand off of the dinghies, to pass bottles of water. And I introduce other characters, including Alexia, who herself has a history of immigration, refugee, but she herself had a normal upbringing in America. So it kind of also talks about their lives crossing each other. I hope people read it. I hope people like it. But I'm very happy I wrote it.
Yeah. I'm happy I read it.
Thank you.
That goes for all three of these books. Elliot, this is, I understand, the 10th in a series of, investigation-based novels.
Murder mysteries set
murder
in Tibet.
Murder mysteries set in Tibet.
And I went through like about 100 rejection slips from publishers way back who said, nobody's ever going to read a mystery series set in Tibet. Why would you do this? And I finally found the right editor. And now, you know, we've done 10 of these novels. They're in 20 languages around the world. So really big, much bigger in Germany than in the U.S., actually. Somebody asked me in an interview some years ago, tell me in a sentence what's going on with these books and why you wrote them. And I said, I'll give you two sentences. The civilization that evolved in Tibet was something that was truly astounding. And what we did to Tibet is something that's truly terrible. Now that gives a little bit of a hint to the complex context that I deal with here. And I know, I imagine, that more than a few of you don't know a lot about the details of the Tibetan occupation by the Chinese government for the last 60 years. The dumbed down outline of my plots would be Chinese investigator who is disgraced in Beijing and sent to prison in Tibet is rehabilitated by Buddhist inmates in his prison, and by solving various mysteries in various contexts, is released from prison and chooses to stay in Tibet to help Tibetans get the justice that their government would deny them. That's the real short form.
Can you tell us, I mean, sort of in line with that sort of initial question, how did you immerse yourself in that reality, and how did you become connected to?
So I was very fortunate to have a life path that took me around the world extensively for decades. I had done a million miles by the end of the 90s and stopped counting. Part of that involved a lot of time in China. I had studied Tibetan Buddhism and Asian history in college. I had some interest, a little bit of background, but as I began to experience China and aspects of Tibet in China, I began to reconsider it and to learn a lot more. I had been writing nonfiction books for many years and was sort of tired of that and wanted to take a stab at writing a novel. And as I learned more about Tibet, I began to realize that there is something that was truly, truly important about this message. The civilization that evolved in Tibet, and it's not an exaggeration to say it was a separate civilization. It had very unique forms of medicine, literature, religion, government, education. It was the closest you might have come and I've read a lot of books about this from travelers that going to Tibet for the first time. It was the closest we would ever come to finding life on another planet, because it was so vastly, vastly different. And they had been living up there. The Tibetans have lived up on the plateau at the roof of the world under really, in terms of human habitation, about the harshest environment you can imagine. For, they're now saying 30,000 years, although this past week there's evidence that was released that there's been at least proto-humans there for 150,000 years. So in this very, very tough environment, they evolved this culture that was you know, very intensely focused on spiritual development. There's a wonderful quote, one of my favorite quotes of all time, by a Jesuit scholar named Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who was a Jesuit rebel, and he said, "We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience." And the Tibetan experience really epitomizes that. And I decided there were a lot of lessons for the rest of the world in how the Tibetans have dealt, how they evolved, but also how they have dealt with a very, very repressive occupation for 60 years. So I was conflicted, wanting to get that message out there, wanting to write fiction, and I had a bit of an epiphany that I could accomplish both by writing a mystery series set in Tibet. Long way around.
Yeah, let me just say one more, direct one more query your way, which is that, you know, Aaron started out this conversation talking about the ways in which Aida is a complicated character, it can't be sort of put in a box, needs to be told in all of her complexity and her nuance. And that's someone who, in many ways, is suffering from human rights abuses. In your novel, there are many complex characters, one of them being Colonel Tan, who is perpetrating human rights abuses and yet has multiple facets. Is that
right?
I mean,
so a theme.
How did you address sort of
I have tremendous interest and respect for the Chinese people and Chinese history and Chinese civilization, and it also is quite amazing, and I'm talking about historic traditional Chinese civilization. So, and I've met a number of Chinese who fit this mold, you know, very classically trained people. Colonel Tan's not so well trained, but people that are somewhat sensitive and spiritual in their own way, who wind up having to take the orders from their government and become the oppressors. Now, Tan is a soldier, career soldier, very tough guy, but he's been based in Tibet now for 40 plus years, and Sean is wearing him down, and in solving his mysteries and finding justice for the Tibetans, he has gradually, and this is a 10 book series, so over the course of the series, he has opened Tan's eyes, and Tan has begun to realize that there is something to this Tibetan Buddhism, and what I'm told for Beijing isn't always really the truth, and there may be some middle ground here where we can find a real justice. So Tan winds up very conflicted himself, and winds up defying a lot of orders to help Sean find justice.
Yeah. I want to turn to the similarities between your two books with respect to borders. I mean, borders are obviously central parts of both of these stories, and I think a lot about borders. And Atiyah, one of the things that I wondered reading your book, you're inhabiting this voice of destiny, and in sort of that persona of destiny. What kind of thoughts? I mean, what kind of sort of predictions came to mind about how the impact of borders could develop and is developing? Obviously, those may be very different things.
Yeah. Well, I kept thinking about the fact that, since this was written by destiny, sort of, from the mindset of destiny, is the fact that our borders are all man-made. And we've created these borders, and we've created these prejudices against each other, these competitions, and how our borders are not seen by, you know, anyone other than human beings. You know, an ant can cross the border, a gazelle can go across a border, a bird can fly. And I touch on it with Tarek at one point, watching birds flying freely from one place to another, and not having to fear everything he has to fear. I think about it. I think about the fact that, you know, we've all come to this belief that these borders are just so ridiculously important and more important than human life oftentimes. I would say in today's day and age, it feels like the majority of time, but really it's something that's been going on since the beginning of mankind. And it's really quite depressing when we put these lines above life. And unfortunately, you know, it's troubling when you see mounds like the graveyards in Lesbos, Greece. You know, Lesbos, which was a vacation island for many Europeans and many people. Now there's a graveyard that's been expanded, and you see these tiny little mounds next to these bigger mounds, and it's families who've died just trying to survive, but they knew they had to try. I know there are a lot of people who say, well, why are they risking their lives? Why are they risking their children's lives? Because really, they think that they have a chance to survive if they go on that boat. They know that they're risking their lives and their family's lives, but they don't feel like they have that chance in the war that has become their country. And I think of my own parents in the sense of, oftentimes people have asked me, well, you know, what would have happened if your parents wouldn't have left? And every scenario that I think of, I know we wouldn't be alive, because I know both of my grandparents were put into prison by the communists when they took over during the first war. One was in solitary confinement. It was hard for them to leave. It was hard for my parents to leave. I mean, families turn against families, and we're seeing that in Syria as well. This is a story that I really want people to try to understand. And one of the best things I will say is that I've had a lot of reader response, and it's been quite amazing for me. And in fact, this has been a book that's been recommended by NPR as well as Fox News, which
I saw that. Yeah. In fact, on your Amazon page, there's someone saying, I heard about this on Fox News, and it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite funny, too, because Dana Perino not only talked about it on her show, she put it on Instagram, and I think she tricked quite a few people because she had recommended it on Instagram, and a lot of people said, well, if Dana Perino recommends this, I'm ordering it right now. And then I actually saw a review on Amazon saying, well, I didn't realize this was going to be about immigrants, but it was good. So if I can open some minds, and one person contacted me saying, I had a completely different viewpoint on refugees, and then I read your book, and it's changed my views, and that meant a lot to me. And I just, that one review alone makes the torture of writing this novel. I mean, I will tell you, I cried almost every day researching this. I cried after my days in Lesbos, after my days in Turkey. I cried reading my notes. I cried reading the articles. I cried talking to people through WhatsApp. We live in a day and age where, you know, I could contact people within Syria to talk to them about their lives, it's not easy. And I just kept thinking, you know, if it's not easy for me to read about, just imagine what it's like for them to live it.
Yeah, I mean, I think something that's in common across all of these books is that you have characters who are experiencing abuses that will never leave them the same again. They will, they're irrevocably changed. And Aaron, you know, your book is coming out in a moment in which the border is a human rights crisis. It's a human rights disaster in a lot of ways that are very similar to the recent past, including the past under the Obama administration, but in ways that are also new. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the way that you leave us sort of with a protagonist, a hero who's moving on, even when she doesn't have hope sometimes. And I wondered how that related to your sort of the way that you look at current events and how you engage with how things are developing now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, the book opens with Ida fleeing across a border with her family to the United States. Fleeing domestic violence, but crossing into a world where she's going to be undocumented. And so in some ways it's a coming of age story, but it's a coming of age story that's really marked by growing up undocumented in one of the most heavily policed small towns in the United States, and kind of how that border presence will mark her and shape her. And, you know, she at one point she's deported and has to fight her way back to and fight for her place in the community that she is fully part of, even though she's legally excluded from. And I won't tell you kind of, I won't spoil the story, but, you know, it takes, you go through immigration, detention, the asylum process, the kind of inner workings of the for-profit immigration detention system, as well as the kind of on-the-ground workings of our approach to border security. And you meet a lot of other folks who are navigating this border as well. And it's really easy at the end of a book like that to kind of end with, you know, in fact, she's in New York City and she's looking at the Statue of Liberty. And you could end it with kind of, yes, in the end, we are a country of immigrants. And that doesn't ring true because, you know, what we're seeing on the border today, the cruelties, is not an aberration or an artifact of Trump. It's something that has a long history in the United States. Immigration control as racial control going back to the 1790s, the current approach that doesn't try to solve immigration in any real foundational way, but instead tries to deter it via ever more cruel, ever more expensive forms of deterrence. Those are things that have been going on for a long time in the United States. You know, so I thought it was really important to kind of not let this be an American fantasy tale about how if you work hard and, you immigrate to the United States, eventually you'll succeed. But there's still a tremendous amount of hope, and the hope comes from her courage and her kind of the wit and the way in which she's able to survive by the seat of her pants and fight for her place in this country. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, in the same way that I'm not particularly optimistic about the legislative process at the moment, coming up with immigration reform, but I am tremendously optimistic about the kinds of new ideas about belonging and membership in the United States that immigrant youth organizations are forging right now in the United States. The way ideas about belonging are changing as a result of those social movements does give hope and optimism. And that's the end that I end on. In fact, there's an epigraph from the a scholar who kind of says, empowering stories don't always have a happy ending, but what they end with is the commitment to struggle and to keep struggling.
Yeah, I like that as a segue into sort of perhaps going back to you, Elliot, with respect to the relationship between the relationship to Buddhist spirituality that Inspector Shan has, which I found very striking, as someone who does it. You know, I do investigative work, and I don't, pause to pray in the middle of my investigations, but maybe there is something that is life-affirming about the way that Inspector Shan has that spiritual practice to return to.
And so part of my goal here is to bring the reader into that Buddhist culture but also to this conflicted culture, because Sean was one of these classically trained Chinese whose family was very sort of embedded in Taoist and Confucian tradition, and he began to absorb Buddhism when he was a prisoner with lamas for years. This conflicted psyche aspect is really important. I think it's an important device for helping readers understand the broader conflict of that region. And that was also one of my goals, getting into this genre, which is, I mostly labeled as writing mysteries. I didn't pick a genre, but my books are classified as mysteries, and mysteries do have a way of drawing the readers in as they try to solve a problem, but the challenge becomes introducing these other deeper background aspects while they're thinking about the mystery. And so what I do is you have to understand some aspect of Buddhism in order to, of Tibetan Buddhism in particular, in order to solve the mystery. And so you want to learn as you solve the mystery.
Mm-hmm. For example, the hail chasers being part of that. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of the ways in which that's embedded in the landscape that you're writing about?
So this is one I alluded to it earlier. One of the fascinating aspects of Tibet is this animistic tradition of what's still called the Bon religion, but used to be the dominant religion in Tibet until the Buddhists came, and instead of, as has been done in a lot of other cultures, wiping the slate clean and getting rid of the old religion, the two religions melded. And so Tibetan Buddhism is incredibly complex, vastly more so than Zen Buddhism, you know, and I don't want to go into a cosmological discussion, but there's a lot of animism, which is finding spirits in nature, essentially. And so the traditional Tibetans feel that, you know, every mountain has a spirit, has a god that lives within it. And there are also a lot of other gods in the air and in the water. There's a long tradition of the hail chasers, or the, you know, kind of weather makers. And this was actually what we might call a profession in traditional Tibet, and these people were mostly very highly educated lamas, highly trained lamas who would roam the countryside and perform rituals to keep the hail off the crops of the Tibetans, because one hailstorm would mean starvation that winter, and so it's very, very important. And I am able to weave in this the current book, Bones of the Earth, the story of a hail chaser who's applying some scientific knowledge as well as his Buddhist training, and is able to use that to really confound the Chinese, because through a series of circumstances and coincidences, they believe that he used hail to kill two soldiers, and then he caused an earthquake at a prison camp. Figuring out those coincidences and the alignment of the facts that took place is, you know, become sort of the essential part of the mystery. Another central part is the effort of the Chinese government, directed out of the national offices in Beijing, to destroy a sacred valley and turn it into a hydroelectric project. And so the gods of the earth and that sacred valley in a way become characters in my book as well.
Yeah. I see, you know, there's I won't give them away, but there are some mysteries and some reveals in your book as well. Part of, you know, moving towards their resolution is moving through so many different steps of finding safety. And I'm struck by how protracted that process is for so many people. I mean, of course, I think that's a completely accurate view of it. I mean, how did you... what was that? I mean, you talked a little bit about what that was like to write. Can you tell us a little bit more about, what's the sort of emotional experience of going through with your character one step after another?
Kind of going back to the fact that, so although this is fiction, it's a work of fiction, everything about it is real.
Yeah.
And every step of the way, I went through the steps that the people I interviewed went through. The stories that they told were very harrowing and very terrifying and really heartbreaking. And the way that I write is I wish I could plot things out. I wish I could just say this chapter is going to say this chapter is going to say this, and this book's going to end this way. But because this is realistic fiction, that's not the way life works. And so I write as I go, and I think of all the people that I talk to and the steps that they take. And everyone that I spoke to didn't have the same journey. So Tarek's journey is different from Jamila, who's another character in the book who is a refugee from Afghanistan, and the stories that I heard from Afghan refugees in the camp. I was lucky in the sense that I can speak the language to speak to the Afghan refugees, the ones that I met in Greece and Turkey and other places. But I also brought a friend along who, luckily, I was very blessed to have very good friends. And since I can't speak Arabic, my friend came along with me to Greece to help translate. I had another friend who helped me in Turkey to make sure everything was done correctly. But when you write, when you delve into something like this, you really do take it in. And if you don't take it in, you're not going to be able to share the story correctly. So as much as I say that I did cry writing and researching, I'm glad that I did. Because if I didn't feel it the way that I did, I wouldn't be able to portray their stories the way that it should be. I think what I really want this book to touch on for the readers is empathy. I think that a lot of people focus on sympathy, and sympathy and empathy are two very different things. And oftentimes people think empathy is a sign of weakness because you do hurt. You feel their pain, and you don't want to feel that pain. You're stronger than that. But empathy is what's really important to get past all of this. I think about the fact that it's human nature to be afraid of something that you don't know. And a lot of people don't understand the plight of immigrants, the plight of refugees. And in a way, they want to stay away from it. And when we try to stay away from something that we don't know, oftentimes that turns into fear. It's human nature to be afraid of something that you don't know, something that terrifies you, something that you don't want to happen to you or to your family. And then oftentimes that fear turns into hate, which is what we're seeing today all over the world. We're seeing it here in America. We're seeing it in Europe. We're seeing it in Asia. It's just everywhere. So my goal is to try to talk about empathy. Try to make the readers feel something, because once you feel something, once you try to understand, and once you have the knowledge, it's less scary. And in a way, you want to help. And I go back to the reviews from some people who were like, I was tricked into reading this. They started to understand more. They were less afraid. The fact that they could reach out to me and say that, well, you know, I actually kind of liked your book. And about a month before, they were like anti-refugee, anti-immigrant. I think even one person literally said on her review, I didn't realize this was about immigrants, but still gave me 4 stars. I was just like, well, that's a good sign. But I think that's the key for me, at least, in my hopes, is to bring in that empathy. And when I went from border to border, I try to put myself in their shoes, whether it was a young man. I was actually afraid of writing the book from the perspective of a young teenage boy. But then I started thinking about the fact that when you are risking your life to survive, gender doesn't really come into play. That said, I talk about Jamila, and we go into the fact that women do have certain experiences that men don't often go through, a certain fear, I should say, when they make these kind of journeys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, interesting, Aaron, in your case, your man, you know, writing about and developing what seems to be had to have been a transformative relationship for you, at least. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I'm sort of projecting that. But one of the things I wondered was, if Aida were here, you know, what do you think she would say about what that relationship changed in her life? As she moves to New York, I'm wondering, mm-hmm. you know, the extent to which telling her story is part of that transformation that she's going through.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily want to say, you know, speculate about what she would say. Yeah. And I'm, you know, just to talk about the how of the book in that mm-hmm. sense, you know, there are, at the beginning of this project, I printed out a phrase from actually from a local Bay Area scholar, Philippe Bergois, who is paraphrasing the Berkeley anthropologist Laura Nader, and it said, "Don't write about the poor and oppressed because anything you say about them will be used against them." And that that really you know was a consistent piece of how I, the kind of the responsibility that went into writing this book. And I didn't go into this project as a journalist. I came into it via ethnography and activism, and you know, recognizing the ways in which you know, writing across difference, as well as you know, it brought about a kind of a way in which I was very attentive to making sure I got the book out to and listened to and learned from scholars and activists who understood the risks of writing a book like this in a really immediate way, talking to immigrant rights activists, having many, many people read the book who are closer to Ida's social kind of position in the world, and getting that kind of critical feedback about the book, trying to navigate the risks of this. But then, you know, Ida throughout the project was saying, we talked a lot about the risks of writing a book like this, and she would say, "I've been through the worst, and now I think that there's a chance that this book could A, help me with my healing, and B, turn all of the suffering that I've gone through into something positive that can make a difference and reach people." And I think that empathy is a key piece of it. You know, the book for me is really about trying to expand the boundaries of empathy that we have in the immigration debates, because it's hard to overstate right now how much our immigration debates rely on this really impossible binary between the flawless, innocent, high-achieving, good immigrant who perhaps deserves empathy, and then the kind of the criminal, bad immigrant who deserves all of the punishment and you know, horrors that could come their way. And I think what Ida taught me was that, you know, that there's this value and a dignity to lives that, first of all, that binary is impossible, that that people can't fit themselves into that binary. But yet that binary, because it drives our immigration debate, it leaves so little room for error for migrants. Rosy Mendoza, the woman I mentioned earlier, says in the book a couple times, she says, "Humans make mistakes, but immigrants can't." There's very little room for error in that. So trying to expand the boundaries of empathy to understand the value and dignity of people whose lives are more messy and complicated than our immigration debate allows is important. And the empathetic and that connection, but also that empathy is not enough. That in many ways, empathy can let us off the hook. Empathy can allow us to say, okay, well, we feel for that person, but it allows us to ignore the way in which we are complicit with the structures and the policies that have made the world unlivable or almost unlivable for that person. And for that reason, the book is not, I say in the end that the book is not, it's not just a book written about Ida to create a kind of empathetic portrait of Ida. It's a book written in collaboration with Ida about the world that the rest of us, those who look at immigration in a more from a more privileged perspective, have constructed, the immigration policies that have been constructed in our name.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I have questions for all of you still. But we have about 20 minutes left, and I'm wondering whether we should open it up to some audience participation. Do we have hands? People who would like to start chiming in? Looks like we do. And I think there is a mic that will come to you. So once that mic is... thank you, sir. First, and... Actually, this is... being podcast, I believe. So the idea is to speak into the mic.
Mr. Pattison, I have enjoyed your books for a long time. How did you move from Tibet to pre-revolutionary America, and what made you create two strains of mysteries?
because you referred to my second series, which is the Bone Rattler series, which is is sort of the Path to Revolution, American Revolution series, starting in 1760. I don't consider that to be, people ask that question a lot. Thank you, and I thank you because it helps me make these points. I don't think that there's a big difference in the broad context of these series. They're both about people who have been abandoned by societies, who have been, you know, orphaned by their justice system. So my protagonist in the Inspector Sean series is Sean, the exiled, disgraced investigator who's been, you know, written off almost literally for dead by Beijing, and becomes a new person after living in Tibet. And he has, if you know the series at all, he has a sidekick, a Dr. Watson mentor, Tibetan mentor named Lokesh, who figures in most of the books. In the Bone Rattler series, the second series, my protagonist is an exiled, disgraced Scot who was in medical school in Edinburgh and got imprisoned and sent as an indentured servant or indentured slave to the New World, to America. And his sidekick, his mentor, is a very aged Indian whose tribe is about to go extinct. And they're trying, and what they do, like Sean, is find justice for people who will never find it from their government. And so it helps me highlight all of these very complex threads of through history in both recent experience and longer term experience of people who have been denied justice, people who have been left behind by their societies, who have been overcome by technology and economic progress, by a larger social group, say, and then more broadly, I feel there's just as importantly as I feel the importance of the message for Tibet, I also feel there's a very important message about the founding of America that's obscured too much in our history books.
Great. Thank you.
I saw another hand back there. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question for Mr. Patterson. In terms of the Tibetan series, did you live in Tibet for a while and absorb the culture and Buddhism that way, or was it more from living in China and researching about Tibet?
When I first wrote the series, I had several people ask me if I had been a prisoner in the Tibetan gulag myself. No, I didn't live in Tibet. I've had a lot of experience and exposure to Tibetans, both in China and elsewhere. And I'm often asked, do I travel still to Tibet? And the answer is no. It's too difficult. I'm pretty well associated with the Tibetan protest movement, and anybody who is associated with that movement who travels to Tibet is followed by the government. And if you speak to a Tibetan, that Tibetan will be arrested. And so don't go there anymore.
Great. One more over here.
Hi, good afternoon. I think I'd like to ask the question to Atia and to Elliot. I'm a journalist. I write fiction. And I have been struggling for some time as a person who takes a lot of testimonies, particularly human rights testimonies, that's what I write about the value of fiction versus the value of journalism. And I have come to a strange place after many years of writing where I think I'm trying to find a way to be able to not write fiction, but be able to find a way to talk about things that can't be documented, particularly things like disappearance and a lot of things that can't be documented by journalism. So I find myself turning to fiction, to what I need to think about or imagine. And I'm just curious to know how Elliot and Atia think about what their choices were around writing fiction. For example, we might write characters, but they're based on people, many people we've interviewed. I find it that I'm struggling between those two things. And I want to be able to write with imagination, but not necessarily call it fiction. I want to write about what's reality, but I also need to bring my imagination to things that cannot be physically documented, like a disappearance or things like that. Just curious to know if you have any thoughts.
So my approach is in a sense that I don't have the imagination anymore. So, but when you go into the fact of disappearance, I go back into the sense of sticking yourself into the story, putting yourself, you know, into their shoes. And, you know, every color, I mean, our world is full of color. Sometimes we don't see it. And I think oftentimes as we get older, it disappears. I see things sometimes my four-year-old will point out that I never would have looked at if he didn't show me. And when I go into my research, I don't just write down what I'm the people that I'm interviewing. I listen to the sounds of the water. I look at the color of the sky. And it's considered fiction, but it's all really real. I do think that right now, I feel like journalism's changed a lot, even since I started taking a pause from it. I feel like since 2014 to today, you know, I think a lot of journalists are using their imagination at the moment rather than focusing on the job itself. If it's advice that you're looking for,
I wanted to know what you think of the value, the relative merit of one sort of approach versus the other. What does fiction allow us to do in terms of writing about human rights that maybe journalism doesn't, and vice versa?
Okay, sorry about
that. You follow?
I think there's value in both. I really do. I think that journalism is under attack right now, and I think that we need to stand up for it. I think that journalists themselves also have to continue to do the proper way of journalism, which is trying their best to tell it as they see it, to go in depth, to do their investigations and whatnot. I think the value in writing is different in the sense of, as I mentioned earlier, as a TV journalist, I was lucky if I had 2 minutes to tell a story. That's not enough time to share the stories of people who are desperate to get their voices out, especially in the countries that I've been to. There are so many people suffering, and when they see you, they get excited to talk to you sometimes. Sometimes they're scared of you. A lot of people say that, well, it's got to be tough to be a woman in these places. In fact, it worked to my advantage a lot of the time, in the sense of the women felt comfortable talking to me. The men felt more comfortable talking to me than my male colleagues. In fact, there were times that I could go behind those mud walls and mud fences, you know, in the villages of Helmand, and the women would allow me to come in and show me their children, show me their lives in a way that my male colleagues never saw. And I thought the value was just as important as a journalist to get their voices out. But it also broke my heart in the sense that I couldn't get their full story out until I wrote my novels. I can put so much more into my books than I could ever do in one report. So I do think there's value in both. I don't think that one trumps the other. I think that what really matters is just putting your full self into either one.
Can I jump in there, actually? Because,
yeah.
You know, we're here sitting with Aaron, who's written this sort of mix between nonfiction and ethnography. And it just must be one of the considerations here is that must just be incredibly painstaking. I mean, how long did you work on this book? And because it reads in many ways like it reads like a fully fleshed out, textured fiction story, but it's of course real.
Yeah, we had this exchange right before the panel that you do realistic fiction, and I said I did novelistic nonfiction. It's 5 years of work with hundreds and hundreds of hours of interviews with Aida Hernandez, her family, her friends, people who were detained with her in immigration detention, her attorneys and doctors, as well as professionals, attorneys, psychologists, doctors who could kind of talk about the plausibility of her story, fleshing out that story. I was really lucky for several reasons. One is because she's an incredibly courageous person who really believed in the value of telling her story. So that was a huge thing. But also that she saves everything. So, you know, we would be texting back. A lot of the research in the last couple of years was done by a text from opposite sides of the country. And we'd be talking about something that happened in her life in fifth grade. And 2 minutes later, I'd get a texted picture of the certificate of achievement from fifth grade. Also, hundreds of pages of medical records, court recordings, police reports, news stories, et cetera, kind of went into the production of this book. So essentially it's Ida's memories interpreted by me, supported by a tremendous amount of research. I definitely am not a journalist in the sense that, like, I coming out of ethnography and activism, I'm a little skeptical of the idea that if you kind of keep yourself at a distance, you can have this pure objective truth. I think that actually our relationships with people and our emotions are an incredibly important way of knowing the world, and that makes the work stronger. So it's her memories interpreted by me, mm-hmm. supported by research.
But maybe not applicable to a situation in which you don't have when someone's disappeared, or you really don't have that kind of foundation.
Can I just offer a quick response? There are two great quotes that I love when I talk about the fiction writing craft. First one is by Emerson. Fiction reveals truth that reality obscures. And the second one is by, I believe it's Hemingway, that a good writer is able to make life more real than life itself. Those are really, provoking points, and I really believe in them, okay? And part of it, and you see it with Aaron and Atia, what they've done, is that we've been indoctrinated by histories and commentaries and reporting that's very sterile, just the facts. Our history books have a lot of charts and graphs and dates and a lot of other antiseptic kind of commentary. But what we do, including Aaron and his nonfiction deep character study, is pull that back and take it to a micro level, and that's what people relate to, and that's the truths that we build on. And so I think all of us are working at that level to get to a bigger structure.
Mm-hmm. More thoughts or additions? Yeah, I see a hand right there.
Atia, I had a question. So you mentioned, like, you've done a lot through a lot of your research. It's been really heartrending moments, and you've cried a lot. I'm curious, as an author, do you try to intensify that emotion when you write, or try to tone it down if it gets too moving? Or to what extent of agency as an author do you try to bring out those emotions while writing about the stuff you research?
I don't try to tone it down. In fact, I don't try to tone it up either. I think that there's no need to tone it up, in the sense of a lot of the stories that I'm writing about are so tragic in itself. I start off the book about two twins, babies, who die in an airstrike. And again, that's based on a real story. There's no need to tone that up. In my first novel, The Secret Sky, I had my editors ask me to tone some things down, because they did figure it would be very hard for the reader and the readers to read. And I did go ahead and tone it down. And the scene was actually in Afghanistan. There's a lot of young women, young girls burning themselves with kerosene and, killing themselves that way. I had to tone it down and instead use boiling hot water, which is something that happens as well. But I think that the situations right now, especially in the places and people that I write about, are so intense that there's no need to tone it up. And my books, although it's primarily targeted as a young adult audience, but I find that more adults actually pick up my book and read it. In fact, I do believe there was a man who said he bought it for his 14-year-old and 11-year-old, and in the end, he's the one who read it and liked it the most, and he was in his 50s. But I think that if to tone it down is to do a disservice. And when some people say, well, what about the children who are going to pick it up? I'm like, these young adults who are reading these books, they know this world. We're not giving them enough credit. And in fact, they should know more about what's going on. And to tone it down does a disservice to them, and it does a disservice to all of us, and it does a disservice to the people that we're writing about.
Would you like to add anything?
Nope. Yeah,
okay. Great.
Same.
Here in the front row, we've got another hand.
Okay. It's to Tia. You've seen what's happening in the places where the refugees come from, and you live in the United States, and you see the response of the civilized world. What's your opinion as to what the future looks like?
I'd go to say that the whole world can be characterized as either civilized or uncivilized. It's not just one place or the other. As when it comes to the crisis itself, I think that we have an opportunity. We have opportunities, and this goes to immigration as well in America. I look at the crisis and as it's being labeled in Europe, and we have an opportunity to help. And it depends on our own reactions and how we take the next step, in which how our world, and I mean ours in general, and to the refugees, how they will be accepted and how our lives will change. If we accept, if we work towards a way of finding a resolution, of helping, I know it seems like an impossible challenge, but we can do things that can help. We can set foundations for these people who have literally, their foundations have been shattered. And if we don't help with providing a new foundation, you know, it's not just their world that's going to suffer. It's our world as well. You know, we're connected in a way in this world that we never have been before. You know, this world has become smaller and smaller year by year, day by day. And the more that we try to push away, that we try to make their lives harder, we make our own lives harder. I personally believe that. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your other thoughts from the panel on that question. Yeah.
Okay. Slightly different. I mean, the first thing I think for thinking about the border and immigration is to put the crisis in the crisis that we're hearing about in perspective. I think that this, for example, this March, you know, people know that the numbers of people crossing the border have been going down steadily for many decades. And then recently, there's been a big deal made about the uptick in March. And it was an uptick. There were 92,000 people apprehended crossing the border in March. And that's the kind of the basis for the kind of the spectacle of crisis that the government is producing. But if you put that in comparison, in March 2000, 220,000 people were detained crossing the border. So half. Now there's twice as many Border Patrol agents actually today than there was in 2000 to deal with that. So I think we need to start thinking in a broader historical way about what's happening on the border. And that will lead us to realize that nothing Trump is doing on the border is new. He's building on the foundations that were laid first by Clinton in particular and carried through the past few decades, and getting rid of Trump will not actually fix the situation. The, you know, Trump has taken things to a more cruel extreme, perhaps, than previous administrations, but he's building on that basis. So in the face of that, you know, the place where I see hope is listening to border communities talk about what real border security would be like. And it doesn't involve more boots on the ground or smart security. You know, the Democrats are talking about smart security now, and that's in very much the same kind of strategy of trying to deter migrants rather than deal with immigration. So thinking about an immigration policy that really acknowledges and is responsible to the fact that the United States, Mexico, and Central America have been connected and interconnected for since before there was a border, that flows of migrants across that space have existed since before there was a border, and really acknowledging the way that connection exists, and thinking about, you know, we first of all need to stop whittling down and attacking the routes of legal immigration. We've been closing down the capacity of people to migrate legally to the United States for a good 10, 15 years. And then create a system that has abundant visas for people who are coming across the border to reunite with family, to come home to their communities in the United States, to work in the United States. And to some people that sounds kind of open border-ish. But in fact, in many ways, it would provide a much more secure and safe border. This is a lesson that border communities want people to hear, is that, you know, what we've done is force migration out into kind of the dangerous and uncontrolled areas in the desert, and instead bring migration back into the realm of visas and ports of entry and inspections and background checks with abundant visas for people who come and go, decriminalizing the act of immigration. And I think ultimately a new sense of belonging that brings back the statute of limitation on deportation. Which is to say, people who have lived in communities in the United States and have actively shaped communities in the United States for many, many years should not have to continually live in fear of deportation.
Great. We just have a few more minutes. Is there anything further from our audience? Yes. Wait till you get the mic. There you go.
Thank you. It's evident that all of you have a macro way of dealing with these very difficult situations. You're immersed in what you all call the writing from the truth of what's going on about very difficult situations, and you all do it with empathy. And it's clear that you are motivated to get the story out and to have more people informed about both what's going on factually and also the micro impact on your characters. I'm interested in understanding, when you're immersing yourself empathetically in these very difficult situations, how do you deal on a micro level with living day to day in a Syrian refugee camp or in Ada Hernandez's life, or as a Tibetan being oppressed by the Chinese government and not having a culture and a place to live freely? How do you deal with, at a micro level, with those difficult things as a writer?
You know, to reiterate something you said, you really do have to take in all of that trauma and absorb it into you in order to bring it back out onto the page. So it is a wrenching experience. And I think the thing that for me has, you know, I couldn't have done this without my family and their kind of real active support, but also being surrounded as I wrote the work with kind of other folks who are working in immigrant rights, and kind of having a sense of community was crucial to this process, because I don't think I could have survived it as an individual. It would have been much harder to do this as an individual, but being kind of doing this kind of work in collaboration and in community rather than alone.
We're going to go on down, and then we might have time to take one more quick comment after we go through Atiya and Elliot.
So after I left Afghanistan, I did suffer from some PTSD that I didn't even realize I was suffering through until my husband pointed it out when I started getting better, I should say. I stopped waking up screaming, and I thought that was normal. I thought it was normal to have a nightmare every night. But for me, writing my first novel, The Secret Sky, which was based in Afghanistan, in a way, it helped. It helped get everything out. And for me, writing this book as well, as I mentioned, it was really, it hurt, but it was getting it out. I was getting it out. And that also said, I do still have anxiety. I have two small kids. I try not to picture them in these situations, but it's hard not to when you're writing it. So as you mentioned, family is a big thing, and just realizing oftentimes how lucky I am, and knowing that tomorrow we could easily be in their shoes, but today I'm not, and just being grateful for that.
Just real briefly, the book in the series 2 books ago was titled Soul of the Fire, and it actually is about the self-immolations of Tibetans. Over 150 Tibetans have self-immolated as protest against the Chinese occupation. That was particularly difficult for me. If you're interested in the Tibetan cause, I strongly encourage you to go on some of the websites. The International Campaign for Tibet maintains a great website with a lot of articles. They maintain a file of the self-immolation victims, and I would consult that frequently. I print it out, and they have pages just on each victim with a photograph and a description of how that person died. And I had a lot of qualms about writing a novel around self-immolation because I didn't want to be commercializing it, and it was very painful because you could see these people and you read about what terrible straits they were in that forced them to self-immolate. But at the end of the day, I know that I did my best to get their story across, and I feel that I did some justice to them, and that helped to give me closure.
Sorry to say that we're out of time. Thank you all so much for the questions and comments, and thank you so much to our panel.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.